From KUOW in Seattle, welcome to Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman. Friendly faces, people waving a hearty hello as you pass them on the sidewalk. Immediate invites to home-cooked dinners. Hospitality is what draws people to Washington State. Said no one ever. Take it from a native Washingtonian, the Seattle freeze is real, folks. No, if you talk to people about the Northwest, they're more likely to mention the natural beauty of the state, the picturesque views of the Cascades, the mossy forests of the peninsula, the rugged edges of the channeled scablands. Today, we're focusing on where that beauty meets concrete and city blocks, in parks. Earlier this summer, we took a trip to a brand new park along the Duwamish River in Seattle's South Park neighborhood. And when we visited this park, the first sound we heard was this. That's the sound of an osprey, and the sound of airplanes flying overhead, and of cars crossing the South Park Bridge. But back to those osprey. There are two living here at the new Duwamish River People's Park in Seattle's South Park neighborhood. The birds just moved in. They're nesting on a man-made tree snag meant to mimic their favorite hangout spots in the wild. The park, designed with community input, it includes a new tidal wetland sitting on the former site of the Port of Seattle's Terminal 117. And a few hundred feet away from the cozy osprey perch, the industrial nature of the Duwamish Valley looms large. Tail fins of airplanes sit in a Boeing lot. Next to that are the rusted remains of a metal forge. People kayak by slowly, floating along the river, fishing poles in tow.
So maybe, like, to put a little context, what you're seeing right here didn't exist.
That's Paulina Lopez, executive director of the Duwamish River Community Coalition. Her organization helped create the brand new park, which stands among factories and across from a Boeing facility, industrial buildings that have been here along the river for decades. Lopez remembers what things looked like here before this park was built.
Asphalt was all over, and in general, like so many pollutants, right? The river has been contaminated, and it was declared a Superfund site since 2001.
If you're not sure what a Superfund site is, that's a place that the EPA has designated as heavily contaminated and a high priority for cleanup. Lopez has lived nearby the site for 18 years, and the last decade of her life has been devoted to organizing her community around the cleanup of this river. Duwamish River People's Park is part of that mission. It represents the optimism that this river will one day be less polluted, a healthier place for people and wildlife like the osprey. Right now, this area still has high concentrations of PCBs, dioxins, and arsenic. The Washington State Department of Health recommends that only salmon be eaten from the Duwamish. Salmon, by the way, spend most of their lives somewhere else. Lopez is here with Nico Peters. Peters is 17 and from South Park. He worked with the Duwamish Valley Youth Corps on creating the park.
We were out here on like days like this. It was hot. We were like digging up invasive species, removing them, and replacing them with more natural, like the plants that were here before, native species.
Lopez and Peters, show me around.
So if you continue, you know, to see into the walkway, first you're going to, of course, witness our Superfund site, which is the river right there. And the Superfund is not the only challenge that we have in this community. Obviously, we're in the middle of an airport pathway, and we have many industries around us. Boeing Field is right across from this site, and one of the highway that is also two highways, I-5, 509-99.
They're not only pointing out the tidal flats and the native plants, they're filling me in on the context of the park. It's hard not to see this piece of habitat as surrounded. Surrounded by industry, surrounded by highways, surrounded by flight paths and pollution. One of the ospreys swoops overhead during the tour.
There he comes, beautiful osprey, just being, feeding the baby.
The osprey is gliding
in front of us. Yeah, she's really feeling ownership of the place now, which is beautiful to see. And to remind us of the hope that exists in this place, you know, like that our youth are the hope that we have been looking at, and they learning about their own environment and creating that ownership, but also like seeing the animals coming back. It's an amazing asset, and it's an amazing moment to remind everyone that we do deserve a clean river.
South Park has a majority Latine population. As a neighborhood, it's a cluster of houses and storefronts nestled in an expanse of industrial buildings. Its residents are more likely to experience negative health outcomes like lower life expectancy and higher rates of asthma compared to the rest of Seattle. On a very warm summer afternoon, Lopez and Peters took time to discuss the Duwamish River People's Park with me and share the hope that this habitat restoration brings. I started by asking Peters what he noticed about the shoreline before this park was created.
Imagine a huge fence right here, all the way down to the Boeing building over there. And everything you saw after that was just mud everywhere. And when the tide came up, the mud disappeared. When the tide came down, the mud reappeared. It was just mud all the time, and it didn't smell very good. So right now you can see they have native plants all over the entire space where the mud was. I think they, what's it called when they take out the contaminated sediments?
They dredge.
They dredged the entire park and put new dirt in and stuff. And when the tide comes in, you can see the water like fully cover this entire space.
And mimicking the way the natural area would have been before people came in and created all of this industrial production.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were saying you and other young people who are from the area actually worked on this. What did that feel like to you to be pitching in and knowing that you were going to create something beautiful here?
Honestly, it felt pretty good, you know. And now that I'm here, standing in front of, you know, like something we created or we helped create, it's like the sense of accomplishment can't be replaced.
This park took years to create. It was a collaboration between the Duwamish River Community Coalition, your organization, the Port of Seattle, and the city. How did the Duwamish River Community Coalition become part of the solution, and what kind of work did you do with those other organizations?
You know, it did take a lot of collaboration with these different entities that you mentioned. But most importantly, I want to highlight that how the work of the community voice was worked on. So when we in 2007 hear the plans from EPA saying, this is how this is going to be clean, that we think it's going to be good. And then we're presenting it to community, and community saying, no, we can do more. What about alternative 1, 2, 3, 4? It's not enough. We want a fifth alternative, and that alternative is how about bringing habitat back and cleaning it fully?
So the EPA presents plans, and the community is like, hold up, we need other alternatives. There's more.
Exactly, because and that's exactly what is happening right now, right? Like with another piece of the river, which is called the East Waterway. So EPA is going to come and say, this is how we think that we've heard we should clean up. Are you okay with it? And that is always so important, always to do community consultation. So that's what happened in 2007. We rallied community, and we took about 200 community members who showed up at the Port Commissioner to really, from the living experience, say, no, we know that we can do more, and you can do more, you can be accountable, and we know that we deserve better. And another alternative is needed, and it's bringing habitat back, but also an open space to a community that has not open spaces or access to the river in a healthy way.
So the priorities for the community were what?
Healthy environment, have access to open space, have access to connection to the river, and also, of course, bring in habitat. And that's what was prioritized to the Superfund. Of course, we have some other priorities, which is clean air. But right now, you know, looking into all the other intersections also for how are we going to protect ourselves from climate and sea level rise. And this also is a good example of, like, you know, things that you can be doing to mitigate that.
I'm really struck by how long this process has been, and the fact that, I mean, 2007 is when these ideas were first presented. I don't know how old you were quite in 2007, but you were two. Nico here was how old?
2 years old.
Wow. And so this process through the Duwamish River Community Coalition and your partners has been working its way through bureaucracy and all the planning and engagement that has to happen to make something like this a reality. Mm-hmm. And then somebody who was two when the idea was first presented actually ended up being involved in building it and creating it with his own hands. I mean, that's got to be an amazing thing for you to have seen through your work and see this come to fruition.
Definitely. Definitely speaks to the mission of our organization, and, you know, which is building capacity with our own community, but also bringing the healthy environment that we need and we deserve, being from the city of Seattle, that sometimes we tend to be forgotten, and how other neighborhoods have access to water, to clean air. So we definitely are here still thinking, how is this going to look like when this river gets to be fully clean in the 5 miles of the Superfund?
We know that people who live near the Duwamish River have poorer health outcomes than the rest of the city. I see you nodding, Nico. What do you think about that? Do you have an experience or something that you want to add about that?
Yeah, so the asthma rates in South Park are higher than all of King County or other communities in King County. So, you know, growing up, seeing all my friends having trouble breathing, it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of sad.
What does that mean to you to be working for the kind of environmental justice that you want to see in the world? Is that something that you want to be involved in going forward?
I think so, because I don't know how to describe the feeling of, you know, I know, like, they promise you that you're going to feel like you're doing something for your community. And like when you first start, you're like, yeah, I doubt it. I'm just a kid. But like as you work towards it, like, or you work in it more and more, you feel more and more accomplishment, and you feel more and more like you're actually doing something. So you start inviting your friends, and they start inviting their friends, and eventually everyone believes in the cause.
Do you have anything to add to what Nico's saying about the importance of youth being involved and the fact that this really is their future?
Yeah, I think at the beginning, as Nico described, is, you know, it's an opportunity you have as a young person. Yes, I'm 13. I can be possibly engaged in my first program, leadership program. There is a stipend, so of course that calls the attention. But I'm amazed by the end of the cohorts that we run. Majority of them want to stay. And you know, we've seen them grow. We start at 13, and then we have them still engage in one way or the other when they're 14, 15, 16, 17. And we have college students even coming back because they have seen the benefit. And this is one of the examples, and a very tangible, to have a park that is representing the work that we've been advocating for, but also the hands, their work, and their future, right? Like, that we see. So it's definitely the way to go when we're talking about what does it mean for an environmental justice community to be defined by those who are being impacted. And that's what we're trying to accomplish.
The Duwamish River People's Park is definitely a huge accomplishment for the community. What else needs to happen here on the Duwamish River? What else are your goals for achieving a measure of environmental justice for the community here?
I think that's a very important question. I see that our government needs to understand that environmental justice is a priority, and the right for people to live in a healthy environment with clean air, clean water must be prioritized. We need to break all those systemic structures that have been not addressing our root causes. Why do we have so many of these inequities in a community that a majority are people of color? We need to make those investments in those communities. We need to work alongside with community, prioritizing the health. And most importantly, we need to bring people at the center of those decisions and build capacity so the people themselves are making those changes.
This waterway has been influenced by man. I mean, it has been moved and changed. But how does the history of the Duwamish River Valley influence your work on environmental justice and everything that's happening here?
So as we are standing here, we are standing on the land of our first people of Seattle, the Duwamish people. And exactly where we are standing, of course, here we saw through the history, like, this was a beautiful, thriving place where our native sovereign nations were here fishing, enjoying the life. And we won't be able to bring it back to how it was. But I think that all the damage that we have created, and, you know, all that economic benefit that Seattle has developed, have been in our backyards. And we haven't seen those economic benefits back, or ecological benefits into our communities.
And it's been at the expense.
It is being at the expense
places like
of
this.
Yes. And community has always been here first, prior to industries. So why is it that the people who now live here have to pay the consequences of it? And we do believe that jobs are important. The industries bring jobs, and we are for it. But we want responsible industries that know that they're following and along and being good neighbors, and that the state, the federal, the state government are protecting us with good regulations so we don't continue to suffer into these injustices.
Nico, what are your hopes for the Duwamish River and for the community around it?
Well, personally, when I was a kid, I always wanted to swim in the Duwamish. So, you know, I mean, that's how every kid thinks. You see a river, you want to jump in. It's hot. I want to get in the water.
I would like to get in the water right now.
Exactly.
So hot.
Yeah. Even to this day, yeah. But I can't put a time on it. But my hopes is that in the future, my kids will be able to swim in the river because I never got that opportunity.
What do you think when you hear that, Paulina?
I actually, when I start getting involved, I thought my kids will be able to swim. So it breaks my heart sometimes. I put all my heart and commitment to it, and even though sometimes it's so redundant to be doing the work and to be knocking on people's door and to the government to be asking them to do the right thing, it's not yet there. But things like this really bring me hope, and seeing kids that are going to be protecting it, and they're going to be there for their next generations to enjoy. It fills my heart. And I know that, you know, thinking about my mentors, James Rasmussen, who spent more than 30 years advocating for this river, that was his hope too. So I can feel his spirit whenever we are going and doing the work that we're doing. But I can see the work being reflected now, and I'm really hoping that this will be the same way, you know, of us, all the people, like that, being advocating for what is right.
Is there anything that you think people should know who have never been on the Duwamish River, but maybe they've lived in Seattle for a long time? Is there anything you think they're missing or that they should know about the South Park community and about this river?
I think that they should appreciate the river, because it's the only river near here. Only river. So if you didn't know that, you know it now. And about South Park, I don't know. I feel like everyone in the community is tired of being neglected. You know, recently, now they're starting to pay attention to South Park, but for a long time, it was neglected. Like, voices were unheard.
How does that make you feel?
When I was a kid, I didn't understand. It's all I knew. Like, I don't know, life felt normal. I was a kid, so I didn't understand. But as I grew up, and as I see, like, you know, the injustices in my community compared to, you know, other communities, we're all the same. So why am I being treated differently than, you know, people from other parts of Seattle or King County? Especially when we have something as beautiful as this here. It's not fair to be neglected like that.
Nico Peters, Paulina Lopez, thank you so much for showing me the park and for your work, amazing, incredible work that you've done to bring this to the community. Thank you.
Of course, thank you.
Thank you so much. We hope to see you again.
You're listening to Soundside. We'll be back in a moment on KUOW. Welcome back to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Summer drives are a way of life here in the Pacific Northwest. You know the drill. Drive out to a scenic viewpoint, inhale that fresh air, feel the sunshine on your face. It's a reward for making it through another drizzly, bone-chilling winter. For over a century, 5 Mile Drive on the bluffs of Point Defiance has given parkgoers one of the most stunning views of the Puget Sound, all from their cars. But this year, Metro Parks Tacoma announced that the road many drivers take to see those views would be permanently closed. This came after a geotechnical assessment found that the erosion of the bluffs posed a safety risk. The report did not explicitly link erosion to climate change, but park officials say they believe there is a connection. Soundside producer Noel Gasca talked to Marty Stump back in May of this year. Marty is the chief planning officer for Metro Parks Tacoma. And Noel asked about how the agency is planning to create a more climate-resilient Point Defiance.
It's a cultural shift when you are asking folks to leave their car closer to the entrance of the park. And it's not something you can do overnight. We have to plan for it and to make incremental changes with that long view in mind that we want to leave these parks in a better condition than we found them when we started. We've been monitoring the encroachment of those eroding bluffs for some number of years. Geotechnical reports that date back to 2013, 2014 began to identify slow but steady erosion and the encroachment to the roadway edge. And these are high bluffs. These are well over 100 feet above the beach elevation and down at Puget Sound. As we really were moving into a planning phase to renovate some of the viewpoints and to potentially relocate some of the parking facilities and so forth as a part of a master plan implementation. The review of the Gig Harbor viewpoint really became alarming given some recent, what we see as accelerated erosion. It seems to be encroaching much more quickly upon the roadway edge. And the engineer at this point made some recommendation that we would really be well served to relocate that roadway about 150 feet back from the bluff edge. And that would mean the construction of a new roadway through an existing forest zone. We know that that's a proposal that would need significant public feedback and involvement, right? Because it begins to suggest the removal of trees and the impact of the very forest that we're wanting to preserve. Point Defiance Park receives over 3 million visitors per year. The zoo, which resides within Point Defiance Park, sees visitorship of 1 million plus or minus per year. A lot of folks who visit Point Defiance Park today come by automobile. The park is not terribly well served by public transportation, in part due to the congestion that happens within the park. With so many automobiles, single occupant vehicles, it's difficult for a bus route to stay on schedule given some of the traffic congestion that they encounter in the park. The park was built around the automobile as being the way you arrive to the park and the way you move about the park. Today, if you want to visit the boathouse in Marina, or Fort Nisqually, Owen Beach, the zoo and aquarium. Because of the extent, the size of the park, and the disconnected nature of some of those destinations, almost demands that you use your car to move about the park. Metro Parks is working toward a multimodal solution or series of solutions that look at public transportation options, enhanced bicycle and pedestrian connectivity, as well as accommodating the automobile, but perhaps consolidating the parking at areas closer to the entry to the park to diminish that congestion and the dependence upon the automobile. We absolutely want to accommodate visitors from all walks of life and able-bodiedness. And we know that there are folks who depend upon automobile to move about the park, in part because we are not well developed for alternative modes of transportation. It's not a one size fits all. We know we need to approach it systematically and look at the infrastructure holistically to plan for a future for the next 100 years of the park.
That was Metro Parks Tacoma's Chief Planning Officer Marty Stump speaking with Soundside producer Noel Gasca. And we wanted to learn more about how Washington's parks are responding to the effects of climate change on our coastlines, mountains, and forests. Lisa Lance is the Parks Stewardship Program Manager for Washington State Parks, and she joins me now. Hey, Lisa, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tacoma's Metro Parks Agency got the geotechnical assessment that led to the decision to permanently close Five Mile Drive to vehicles back in January. And while the report didn't explicitly link the bluff's erosion to climate change, park officials have said that they do believe climate change is behind it. What do you think that decision says about the challenges parks across our region are facing as we move into this new era where the effects of climate change become increasingly visible?
Well, I think we will continue to gain greater understanding of what the potential obstacles are for managing these lands. You know, we around Puget Sound, historically, those bluffs are feeder bluffs. They erode and provide habitat along the sound. And there's been a lot of shoreline protection in many areas that have disrupted those processes. So to a certain extent, that bluff erosion is natural, but certainly the more intense rainfall events that we have begun to receive that are related to climate change, I think certainly do play a role in some of these landslides and other erosive events that we're seeing.
Back in 2017, the Washington State Parks Commission partnered with the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group on a climate change vulnerability assessment. What did that report tell you about how and where our state park system is vulnerable to climate change?
Well, that report identified essentially four specific areas or vulnerabilities within the state park system. The first of which was changes in precipitation and stream flow. Going back to those more intense rainfall events that I just mentioned, also the time of year when we may be seeing runoff from the mountains is likely to change as a result of changes in our climate. The second element was changes in snowpack. Washington State has the highest percentage of warm snow in the U.S. In other words, snow that falls near near freezing. And so it doesn't take a great deal of an increase in temperature to cause that precipitation to begin to fall as rain instead of snow. The third element that we identified for the state park system are changes in ecosystem health and vegetation disturbances. Wildfire is the most obvious one of those, but it will have impacts on our plant communities and our ability to maintain and restore those. And then finally, for the state park system, a big thing for us is sea level rise, given the percentage of our parks that are located in close proximity to Puget Sound or the ocean beaches. One park that I could point to that we're working on right now is Saltwater State Park within the city of Des Moines. We are collaborating with King County on a salmon restoration project at the park, but an element of that restoration has to do with adapting the park to sea level rise. So currently the park during king tides, a portion of the park floods, one of our buildings floods. We also have historic structures at the top of the bluff that are growing increasingly close to the edge of the bluff. So things that we're considering doing as part of the restoration, or in tandem with the restoration rather, is removing buildings that are particularly susceptible to sea level rise and storm surge. We're looking at building facilities that are farther back from the shoreline and actually putting in some fill to make sure that they are protected from projected sea level rise in that location. And we're also looking at relocating our historic structures farther back from the bluff to buy them more time as erosion moves forward. So that's one example of where those particular impacts are showing up that we're dealing with within the state park system.
Obviously, with the Washington State's state park system, you're dealing with decisions that have been made maybe decades ago, maybe 100 years ago, in terms of where certain infrastructure is built, how it's built. In the case of Metro Parks in Tacoma, we just heard earlier from Marty Stump, the deputy director of planning for that agency, and he highlighted that Point Defiance was designed in a way that prioritized vehicle transportation as visitors' main way to get through the park. And the outer loop of Five Mile Drive was, you know, an example of that. What other kinds of decisions are you with Washington State Parks trying to grapple with today that had been made in the past, but now you have to adjust in order to make the parks more climate resilient?
Well, I think obviously transportation to parks, a lot of our parks were built around that car transport model. So there are places where we are going to have to take a hard look at what our priorities are. We've certainly built parks in places that we probably wouldn't choose to build a park today, based on what we know about climate change, et cetera, things that are coastal hazards that we might not have recognized in the past. So in some of those instances, we're going to have to make some tough decisions about, do we want to continue to make efforts to adapt the site to allow a park or those the type of infrastructure to continue to be there? Or are there places where we will perhaps move back? And those are going to be some tough decisions moving forward. But we certainly have had instances in the near term where we've had to make some decisions. At Cape Disappointment State Park down at the mouth of the Columbia, we have had to close certain campsites as a result of coastal erosion. They're probably some of the most profitable and popular campsites within the state park system. But the risk had been too great to continue to occupy those. As we look forward with longer range plans, we'll also have to start to look at sort of the greenhouse gas reduction, look at things. Will we continue to build campgrounds to accommodate very large RVs? Will those still be a trend in the future? Those are things that we're going to have to consider in our plans moving forward.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the ways that you think about cars and large recreational vehicles. These are carbon producing equipment that people bring into the parks. Obviously, there's accessibility issues that you have to consider when you think about car access. How do you as an agency balance all of that, the pollution that's created by cars, while also balancing things like access for people with disabilities?
Well, it's definitely a challenge. It's important for our parks to be accessible to people of all abilities. But I think one of the things that we're considering right now as an agency is our own agency greenhouse gas emissions. Legislation was passed in 2020 that requires us reduction targets moving forward through 2050. And we're going to have to make some hard decisions as an agency in terms of how we operate. But we're also going to want to look at, what are the recreational activities we're providing and really what are the trends for the future? Will large RVs that have a significant carbon footprint be something that people will still be wanting to use? I think we want to make sure that we're not transitioning to a recreation model that we can envision will be obsolete a few decades from now.
Lisa Lance is the Park Stewardship Program Manager for Washington State Parks. Thanks very much for stopping by.
You're welcome.
This is Soundside on KUOW. This is Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman. If you've ever taken a walk around Volunteer Park in the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle, you know that smack dab in the middle of this bustling public space is a pool of water. It's surrounded by a chain link fence with a walking path looping around the perimeter and signs saying, "Do not feed the birds." It's not just a reflecting pool or a lake, it's a reservoir. And that got us curious. How did it get there? And are we really drinking that water? Luckily, Soundside is a show built to answer these kinds of questions. So we met up with an expert on the park to explain.
We ended up with a reservoir in the park because we have the coolest water system in the world. Hi, I'm Jennifer Ott. I am the chair of the Volunteer Park Trust. The way it was designed in the 1900s, or early 1900s, is that the water comes down from the Cedar River watershed. The gravity of the downhill movement of the water pushes it back up to the top of each of our hills where the reservoirs are located, Beacon Hill and Capitol Hill, and up in sort of the Green Lake Wedgwood area. And then from those reservoirs, it falls by gravity to the homes and businesses that need the water. And so this one is for this area that is served by this reservoir, everything downhill from it. The only exception to that is that the water tower serves all of those places on Capitol Hill that are higher than the reservoir, because the reservoir is set into a ravine. It was such a perfect place to put a reservoir. And so to serve those areas that are above the reservoir here, either this reservoir or the one at Cal Anderson, they put in the water tower in 1908. And that is, the water is pumped up to the water tower, and then that serves all of the places on the hill that are above the reservoirs. So the city purchased the land on what's now Capitol Hill for a park in the late 1890s. And it wasn't developed, it was sort of used for different things. There was a greenhouse, there was a cemetery for a short time. There is the municipal water system features, the reservoir was already here. And so when John Olmsted came to Seattle in 1903 to develop a park system for the city, he really looked at connecting these hilltop areas, some of which were already designated as parks, some were just water system elements at that time. I really want the reservoir to stay a water feature. I know that it is also a water facility, which is a different thing. And so SPU will have to determine how it fits into their system. But if you look at the park as a sort of mini system, it's an essential part of the Olmsted design and the visitor experience. And so much would be lost if we lost that reflecting pool of the reservoir and that wasn't retained. In the 70s, when there was first proposed to cap the reservoir for safety reasons, the city proposed painting the cement that it would be capped with reflective paint, so that it would be like a reflecting pool. And I'm so very grateful that didn't happen. There's been all sorts of ideas, so many ideas that are like outside the box, and I think that could be really exciting. The Buffalo Olmsted Conservancy, there's the first public park system in the United States was in Buffalo, designed by Frederick Law Olmsted Sr. and Calvert Vaux. And they had this massive wading pool that was not feasible to maintain as a wading pool. And so instead they turned it into a skim of water in the spring and fall. And then in the winter, it's an ice skating rink. And in the summer, it's a splash park. And that sort of kind of genius thinking is what I think is going to be needed here, is to figure out what is the incredibly clever solution that, you know, water's difficult.
Water is difficult. As Jennifer said, some neighbors would like the Volunteer Park Reservoir to become a reflecting pool or an ice skating rink or a multitude of other things. But for now, it's still part of the Seattle Public Utilities water system. And there's a seismic reason for that. Alex Chen is here to explain. He's the director of drinking water at Seattle Public Utilities. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby.
So we're talking about the Volunteer Park Reservoir today. Give us the basics on that. I mean, what's the Volunteer Park Reservoir doing right now? Is it supplying water to the city?
It is not. On an everyday basis, it's disconnected from the drinking water system. It's available for emergencies. So we did a major seismic study in 2018 and looked at what would happen in the event of a large earthquake. Volunteer Reservoir was originally scheduled for decommissioning, meaning disconnected from the water system and used for other purposes. We know that it has an important function in the park for historical and cultural purposes. So we were working on what would the future of the reservoir be. The reservoir was installed about 100 years ago. It was one of the earliest parts of the drinking water system. And in the 1990s and 2000s, we were looking at meeting all the latest water quality regulations, which included covering all the reservoirs that have all the treated water stored throughout the city. We were trying to figure out the best balance between water quality, cost, rates, and we decided that Volunteer Reservoir was no longer needed as part of the drinking water system and made plans to decommission it. However, in 2018, as part of that seismic study, we understood that the level of seismic risk now is much bigger than what we had looked at in 1990, our last major seismic study. Everyone's heard about the Cascadia subduction zone and Seattle fault earthquakes. And what we decided is that even the Volunteer Reservoir wasn't needed as part of the everyday drinking water system. It's really critical after emergencies for emergency storage of water for firefighting. So on an everyday basis, it's disconnected from the drinking water system, but it's able to be used for firefighting after major emergencies. We maintain it, Seattle Public Utilities. We work closely with the Parks Department on any maintenance or aesthetic issues. We work closely with the community, the Volunteer Park Trust, just to listen to what concerns citizens have. Obviously, people walk around that reservoir. It's a big part of the aesthetics of the park. We recognize that. And so a lot of our maintenance activities are geared with the community's needs in mind.
And that backup role that it has in the event of an earthquake, it's all about water pressure, right? And especially right after a major event, firefighters really need that water pressure in order to fight fires.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, we work very closely with the Seattle Fire Department on firefighting needs after emergencies and everyday firefighting needs, of course. So right, maintaining water pressure in the system is a key element. And then as a backup, if there are many leaks in the system after a really big earthquake, as we're triaging the leaks and fixing them, another approach is to have sources of water at our reservoirs that the fire department can go to draft water and bring water to fires to fight them.
So the Volunteer Park Reservoir is an open reservoir. It's not capped. And I'm assuming that one of the reasons that it's not able to be used, it's not up to modern standards for a reservoir, is because it's open air. What are the requirements for a modern reservoir in order to, you know, supply drinking water on a daily basis to a city?
There's many requirements in terms of the design and construction and maintenance, but I think the one that you're really focusing on in on is the requirement that treated water reservoirs throughout the city be covered for water quality protection. That was part of regulations that got put in on a federal level in the 1990s, and we're fully in compliance. But what that means is that it's expensive to cover reservoirs. Oftentimes, what we do is cover them and put parks on top for the community's benefit. We work closely with community and Seattle Parks on the design and how those work, but it does come at a cost. And so when we were looking at those regulations, one of the thoughts is, how do we keep rates affordable while meeting water quality and emergency and other needs? So Volunteer, like I said, was one of those reservoirs where we looked at the system and on normal operations, it's not needed as part of the system. It might be in the future as people continue growing into Seattle and the need for water keeps on increasing. But on an everyday basis, because it's not needed, we decided that for rate affordability, we would disconnect it from the drinking water system and not spend the money covering it and leave it for aesthetic purposes for the community in the park.
What kind of maintenance does it require now? Because it's only a backup. It's not used for drinking water, but in the event of an emergency, it might be called into service. What does Seattle Public Utilities have to do to maintain it?
It's a couple of basic elements here. We try to fill the reservoir and turn the water over on occasion so that it stays clean, pretty clean for, you know, it's for emergencies, not for drinking water. We also recognize, though, that the community values the aesthetic of that reflection. When you stand at the museum and look down at downtown, the water is reflected on the skyline. So we'll try to turn over the water. And then every year or so, we'll drain the reservoir. We have a storage crew that maintains all of our reservoirs. They'll wash it out, make sure the sediment is cleaned out of the reservoir. We'll do a structural inspection so that the concrete sides, if there are any issues, we can fix those. And then we have a whole checklist of the things that the maintenance crews will do. And then we fill the reservoir back up.
Theoretically, what would it take to call the Volunteer Park Reservoir into service and prompt you to actually cap it and make it into a usable reservoir?
I'm an engineer, so I'd start from the technical aspects here. So a lot of the policies in place for us govern how much storage do we think we need on an everyday basis? And then as the population grows, how does that policy reflect more storage being needed on an everyday basis? So following those typical rules, we would look at how does population grow over time and look at those triggers for when we need more treated water covered storage in the system. At this point, we're not seeing that need right now. The other factor that might come into play is that if utilities look at resilience and flexibility, what we're seeing is a heightened desire for more tools at our disposal in the event of climate change-driven impacts or operational needs or other flexibilities. So in the future, if we looked at these and worked with our community and electeds and ratepayers to say, it's probably worth having more treated water storage per person than we do now for the following reasons at this cost, and we can come to that conclusion, that would also lead us to add more storage back into the system.
What about the idea of transforming the Volunteer Park Reservoir entirely into an ornamental water feature? The Seattle Public Utilities deciding it's not going to need it, you know, in the future, and the neighborhood can just use it as a water feature. Is that something that's feasible, or is the need for that backup water in an emergency just outweighing the idea of turning it into an ornamental feature for now?
I think you hit the nail on the head that the seismic study we did really looked at how much risk the community might be in the event of a large earthquake, and emergency post-earthquake firefighting water was such an important need that that has been seen to outweigh any, you know, idea to make this purely ornamental. However, from a community perspective, what the community saw when the reservoir was in service as a treated water part of the drinking system is not that different from what they see now that the reservoir is disconnected but available for emergencies.
Alex Chen is the director of drinking water at Seattle Public Utilities. Thank you so much for explaining all this to us.
Thanks for having me. Sure appreciate it.
That was an edited version of a story that originally aired in July of this year. You can find the whole segment online at kuow.org/soundside. To end today's show, we're going to meet somebody who spends his time introducing people to Seattle's Seward Park. As the lead naturalist at the park's Audubon Center, Ed Dominguez teaches visitors about the area's birds, other animals, and plants. Soundside producer Jason Burrows joined one of Ed's early bird treks, and they talked about his love for the natural world.
Two of my big passions are music and the outdoors. And I was fortunate enough to have a father who was an amateur naturalist in his own right. And some of my earliest memories, you know, before I could even walk, were my dad taking me out in the forest where we lived in Northern California and showing me bear, deer, birds, trees, and got me connected to the importance of everything in the natural world. And that's something that stayed with me my entire life. Now, we have two species of owls that nested in the park this year, and they do regularly, the barred owl and the barn owl. I found that with the pandemic and people having to stay socially distanced, it really increased their desire to get outside and connect with something that would ground them and make them feel centered and stable. And nature was the avenue that they chose. And now that things have opened up more, we're back up and running here. They also are very good at cleaning up on the Norway rats and black rats that infested our city. So the adult owls are good at getting the eastern cottontails, the bunnies that are everywhere. But they'll also eat other birds. Some owls are good fishermen, fishing birds, so they'll eat fish. We are entering a new and more enlightened age of respecting the fact that inclusivity, diversity, equity, the EDIB issues are very important, and we want to be part of that. To me, even the name society, like National Audubon Society, society connotes something that's exclusive or select. And what we want to be is all inclusive. We want to make sure that everyone is welcome to come, no matter what your ethnicity, no matter what your socioeconomic background. And so I think anything that broadens that welcoming to all peoples to come in is a move forward and a positive move. So the juveniles have a yellow eye, not a red eye. Oh. And instead of the orange and white,
oh,
kind of horizontal chevrons on the breast, they've got a white breast with brown vertical stripes, big, long. Huh. And there are four of these birds, and they make that sound that you just heard, which is kind of a whistly. The effects of climate change have affected human beings as well as the natural world. The main thing that I've seen that's really taken a hit are our trees. Since 2014, we've been in successive summer seasons of drought stress and heat stress. Think of it as if your immune system gets suppressed, you have a much tougher time fighting off colds. If you get a bruise or a cut, it doesn't heal as quickly. The heat and drought stress have made our trees much more susceptible to all of these invasive agents, and they're having a tough time fighting them off. And if our birds and insects don't have trees, the whole system can collapse. So that's the main thing I've noticed, is trees are having a tough time. Birding is no longer just, you know, the bird nerds. Kids are coming in elementary school age. They're already really knowledgeable about birds and bird songs and calls. I mean, the more birds you know and the more songs that you can recognize, it is the cool thing now. It's not like you're a nerd at all. It's like you're really hip and cool. So that's a great trend. Keep that growing. Feeling and seeing the connection of people when they make a personal discovery for themselves in nature is incredibly rewarding and gratifying. The tree in the background on the right-hand side, there's a big Y shape.
Oh.
And see, the nest is sitting right in that Y, right in the crotch of the Y and the tree. The sunlight's hitting the branches. Every time I take a group out, it's always that same freshness and excitement when I see people connecting with nature. It never gets old. I never feel jaded, because I think it connects with me when I was a kid. And my dad would show me a bear. It's like, wow. When I connect people with that, it strikes a chord of resonance inside me that gives me that feeling. So I keep wanting to do it over and over, and seeing those people connect, it never gets old. It's always just a life-sustaining energy that I'm happy to share with people.
That's it for today's show. Thank you for listening to Soundside on KUOW. Today's show is produced by Hans Anderson, Jason Burrows, Noel Gaska, and Sarah Leibovitz, with support from Alec Cowan. I'm Libby Denkman. Thank you for listening to Soundside on KUOW.